Now, don't you notice, as we begin Nehemiah 10, it states those who, well, we should read, I'm sorry, I should read verse 38 to give us the connection, so we go over into verse 1, because it kind of opens the whole chapter. We make a sure covenant, he says, and write it, and our leaders and our Levites and our priests seal it. And then we have listed in chapter 10 those who placed their seal on the document were. Now, what did they express in this covenant? This is what really, I think, is outlined for us here in chapter 10. You'll notice that, first of all, they covenanted to walk in God's law, didn't they? Notice in verse 29, they joined with their brethren, their nobles, and entered into a curse and an oath to walk in God's law, which was given by Moses, the servant of God, to observe and do all the commandments of the Lord our Lord, and his ordinances and his statutes. So, they were making an agreement with the Lord, they covenanted with the Lord, that they would walk in God's law. And certainly, to have such an objective, to have such a determination, after what had taken place, we could call this a new start, really, couldn't we, for the people. God had given them the city of Jerusalem, so to speak, back again. He gave them the temple back again. He walled their city. And they were ready, as it were, to start anew. Obviously, there is a little problem connected with covenant, entering into a covenant with the Lord. Covenants, as you know, can be in the Bible, in the Old Testament. And we have the New Covenant, of course, carried over in the New Testament. Covenants can be, they do not have to be two-sided. That is, a covenant can be one party promising another party something. But on the other hand, a covenant can be one-sided. Somebody promising to do something regardless of what the other party does. Now, most of God's covenants that are, we would call everlasting, that is, covenants that are continuous, are one-sided. God says, this is what I will do. And that's it. There's no ifs, there's no, you know, if you walk in the law of the Lord, or if you do this, or if you do that. The Abraham covenant, for example, is a one-sided covenant. Abraham didn't have to promise God to do anything. God said, Abraham, this is what I'm going to do for you. On the other hand, the Mosaic covenant was two-sided, wasn't it? The people said, you tell us what to do and we'll do it. They were entering into an agreement. So the Lord said, all right, here's what you're doing. He said, okay, we'll do it. Now, you can quickly see as I describe this, the difference between a one-sided covenant and a two-sided covenant. You can quickly see we know what the problem is, isn't it? The problem is always on our side, not on the Lord's. The Lord never fails. The Lord always keeps his promises. The Lord enters into an agreement, he keeps the agreement. But we're the ones that fail. And thank God, our salvation finds its basis in the new covenant. And please don't misunderstand me. I did not say that the church is the new covenant. I didn't say that, because that would be an erroneous statement. But I'm saying the blood of Christ, the salvation, the foundation of our salvation, is established on a covenant that God made. The new covenant. It has nothing to do with our part, our relationship. Now, the reason that I'll tell you why I'm stressing this, because we're going to see that the people entered into this in chapter 10 with great enthusiasm. And they meant it. They were sincere. Much had taken place that they were very thankful for. But as always, they were failing to keep in mind that there's a weakness when man enters into a covenant. And notice the second part of their covenant, verse 30. They're basically saying, that they would not give our daughters as wives to the peoples of the land, nor take their daughters for our sons. Now, actually, that was a very important statement for them to make, because basically they were touching on what was one of the greatest problems with Israel, what really brought about the fall of Israel. You know, from the time of the third king of Israel, from the time of King Solomon, right on down through the kings of Israel, the kings of Judah, we know that one of the basic things that brought about the fall of Israel was that they entered into agreement with the daughters of the son of the people of the land, and they led them into idolatry. They got into Baal worship through Jezebel. They got into other worship of other gods through the women that they married. So they were recognizing, in making this covenant, they were recognizing a great weakness on their part. They knew this. But the problem is they were not mindful that the years, as the years go by, or even the months, many times we make promises, we make agreements with God that we're not able to fulfill. And we're going to see that that's precisely what happens here as we finish up our study in Nehemiah. In verse 31, they agreed not to allow covetousness to violate the Sabbath. In other words, apparently there was the danger of not keeping the Sabbath, using the Sabbath as a time to sell grain to make money. They make a promise not to do this on the seventh day. And then in verse 32, they make the promise to give to the service of the house of God. They make a promise to give of that which the Lord had given them. We can see in all four of these areas, they certainly, you know, we have to commend the people in that they saw what were the dangers of the past. They, in other words, here was a good thing. They recognized the weakness of their own heart. They knew that they had not walked in God's laws in the past. They knew they had, their sons had made unequal yokes, unequal agreements with women in the land, got themselves into difficulties. They knew they had abused the Sabbath because of their covetousness and their, and they knew that they were greedy with their money. You know, a Jew is known for that he likes to hold on to his money. Although I'm not so sure that the Irish and the Scotchmen and the Germans and the English don't run a very close second to them. We like to hold on to our money, don't we? You know, this is, in other words, it's a human thing, isn't it? When we're given something to cling to it for ourselves. Now, I think the important part of this, the lesson to me that's in here in this 10th chapter, without going into a lot of detail, simply because for one thing, we don't have the time to do it. But to me, the key thing here is this. You and I often, just like the people of Nehemiah's day, when we begin to make spiritual connections, when things begin to happen in our life, when we see the wheels turning, when we see us going in different direction, there is a subtle thing can take place, and we have to watch this. That is, we, looking back over our life, we can see, before the Lord really started working our lives, we can see some of the pitfalls that we really fell into. You know, we can see how we messed up our life in this area and that area. And that's what these people were doing. And so, as a result, we make promises to the Lord. And so, now, Lord, from now on, this day, I'm, you know, dedicating my life to you, and I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm not going to do that anymore. Now, be cautious about this kind of approach in your spiritual life. Because what happens is, when you put yourself under commitments that you're holding yourself personally to hold, there's a good likelihood you're going to have to be taught the lesson that you're too weak to do it and you're not able to do it. The many times you're going to fall back into some of those very pitfalls. What we need to do is rather to develop the attitude, Lord, you know, here's what I've done. You keep me from these things. You work in my life, you know, and recognize your need of Him. And if you fall back into some of these pitfalls from your past life, don't consider it the end of everything. In other words, so often this happens in the Christian life. So, well, Lord, I failed. I made a mess of things. And it's almost as if you're discovering how bad you are, and you're so alarmed that you figure God's through with you. And you don't realize that God all along knew how bad you were. And God knew your capabilities toward evil. You didn't surprise God. You just surprised yourself. That's basically what often happens to us. We learn ourselves. You see, we begin to learn about ourselves what God already knew about us. So what I'm saying here is there needs to be, even though we've had past victories, we've seen God work in marvelous ways as these people did, let us not become over assured that we are now, you know, never going to stumble again. We're not going to do this or that. When we come into chapter 11, this is really here in chapter 11, as you page through, you see a list of names again. And this is a list of the active, those who've been active in the work of the Lord. There is, I think we would agree, there is in every Christian assembly or every Christian church, there is a list. Now, I don't mean to say it's a list that would be on the bulletin board, or it's a list that's been printed out, or I don't mean to suggest that, but there is a list in every group of active Christians who are really carrying the work on. In other words, you can take, I was talking to someone some time ago, and they were asking me about the size of our group, you know, and I told them, well, we're not very large. We may be number 40, 50, something like this. I said, now, well, his next question was, now, how many of that 40, 50 would you consider active? You know, really participating, really doing the work. I said, well, you know, it would be hard to say. I don't know. Maybe half, maybe somewhere, something like that, or maybe less. And he said, well, you know, he said, you'd be talking then, let's just say, he said, just for the sake of numbers, okay, let's say you have 40 in your group and half of them are active, that's 20. Now, he said, I'm in a group where there's 200. But he said, we probably only have about 20 that are active. in other words, there is, and sometimes it seems to be the larger the group, the smaller the percentage that are really active in the work of the Lord. But we do have here the list. Notice verse 1 says, now the leaders of the people, this is chapter 11, dwell at Jerusalem. The rest of the people cast lots to bring 1 out of 10 to dwell in Jerusalem, the holy city, and 9/10 were to dwell in other cities. And now, note this verse. And the people blessed who? All the men who willingly offered themselves to dwell at Jerusalem. They willingly offered themselves. These were those who were committed to go on for the Lord. Somebody wrote a little poem that I like very much. It goes like this. Go on, go on. There's all eternity to rest in. Singing that word for a minute. Go on, go on. There's all eternity to rest in. And far too few are on the active service list. no labor for the Lord is risky to invest in. But nothing will make up should his well done be missed. And surely, as we read, as I say again and again, these names, we're well aware that these are those who were marked down for all eternity, so to speak, as those who were active in the Lord's work. Let me go over to chapter 12. Again, confronted with this continuing. This is really a continuation. They're specifically mentioned now, the priests and the Levites, as we continue on this list. And we can really say verses 1 to 26 belong to the list in chapter 11. Why they made the division there, I'm not quite sure, except maybe because they wanted to distinguish the Levites from the other divisions. But then in verses 27 to 47 of chapter 12, we have the dedication of the wall. The wall had been finished. Nehemiah's mission, so to speak, was done, and now it was time for dedication. This was nothing unusual with the Israelites. You remember one of the great dedications of all times in the Old Testament was when Solomon completed the temple. This was a great time of dedication because it represented years of labor, years of hard work. It represented the vision of many brethren and sisters who had struggled and looked forward and longed for this time, and now it has occurred, and so they would have a time of dedication. Notice that it's marked by thanksgiving. If you look at verse 27, specifically states there, to celebrate the dedication with gladness, both with thanksgiving and singing. Certainly, they could look back and see what God had done, and they were thankful for it. And it was a time of great joy. Notice in verse 43, that day they offered great sacrifices and rejoiced, for God had made them rejoice with great joy. The women and the children also rejoiced, so that the joy of Jerusalem was heard afar off. Now, I wish our chapter ended there. I wish we could say, well, that's it. That's the story of Nehemiah. Be a nice story, wouldn't it? Be a beautiful story. We see how God took a people who were willing to believe and in difficult times and come back and struggle with the building of a wall against many obstacles and enemies, and see that wall go up and see restoration and Bible study and prayer and dedication to the Lord. And you think, hey, what a nice story. But you know, so often the Bible is this way. The next chapter gives us a totally different perspective of the people that went back there to Jerusalem. The next chapter, we have to note that failure, serious evils set in as we conclude the study here. You say, well, isn't it too bad that the story has to end that way, but isn't that the whole story of man? You know, isn't that the story of mankind? Isn't God making us aware that failure is what often comes about with man as time goes by? Often the best movements for God, the greatest things that have happened, end up in failure. We can point to this time and time and time again. If you were to look at the church period, the history of the church, you know, you will find certain times when there's a great time of revival. But the very people who form a part of that, that when the next generation comes along, we find a slow declension from it until you wouldn't even recognize what had happened. I remember one of the first times this lesson came to me. I was going I was going to play basketball in the YMCA. And I had never looked into what YMCA, you know, really meant. I knew it was Young Men's Christian Association, but I figured that was just a name and so forth. But then I began to discover as I went there, I was reading some of the pamphlets and looking up some of the things, and I found out that the YMCA one time was a vibrant work of God. It was a organization that started by the vision of some young men, and they had Bible studies all over the country, in colleges and cities and that. You know, it was a movement that was mightily blessed of God. Well, as the generations went by, the YMCA today, you would find nothing at all to indicate, you know, it's strictly the physical. You go there to work out, you go there to swim, you go there to tone your muscles, but there's nothing of Bible study or of God. It's gone, totally gone. See? And that's just a one example of what's been the case of hundreds of movements. Well, what does it show us? It shows us that just because one generation, you know, vibrantly responds to God and things begin to happen and there's repentance and there's movement and that's no guarantee the next generation is going to be that way. That's no guarantee those that follow it. So, in other words, you and I have a challenge, and that is, if we can look back to a godly heritage, if we can look back to movements of years ago that were used of God, our challenge is, are we remaining under the benefit of what took place? Do we have the same spirit? Do we share the same spiritual concern? Chances are we probably don't. Chances are we become cold and callous and unconcerned. Chances are that what was once vibrant and mighty for God has become slow and slothful. And that's what's occurred here. And we're going to wind up our study, we're going to read through Nehemiah 13 and make just a few comments as we go down through, and that will conclude our study of the book. Chapter 13, verse 1. On that day, they read from the book of Moses in the hearing of the people, and it was found written that no Ammonite or Moabite should ever come into the congregation of God. Now, this is specifically mentioned over in Deuteronomy 23, but there's other portions, but they were probably, more than likely, reading in Deuteronomy. And the reason we find this so much in Deuteronomy is because Deuteronomy, remember, was what Moses brought before the people in preparation for their entering into the land. And God knew that when they entered into the land, this would be one of the dangers. There were people in there. The danger would be they would not follow his instructions get rid of them, but they would rather bring them into them and marry them. So they were given this exhortation. Now we think, well, this is great. We're going to have another Bible study. We're going to have another Bible reading. We're going to have a great response. No, that's not what's happening here. They discovered, as they were reading here, something they should have known, something that I'm sure had been read to them in the past. But they found written, no Ammonite or Moabite should ever come into the congregation. Because, verse 2, they had not met the children of Israel with bread and water, but hired Balaam against them to curse them. However, our God turned to curse and no blessing. And there we refer back to the incident of Balaam in Numbers 22 and 23, where he, a Moabite, caused the people to sin against God. Verse 3, so it was, when they had heard the law, that they separated all the mixed multitude from Israel. Now before this, Eliashib the priest, having authority over the storerooms of the house of our God, was allied with Tobiah. What? Am I reading? This can't be right. I must be reading a wrong version. This Tobiah? This man that was giving them all these problems? This man that was their arch enemy? This man that cursed them? This man that tried to lead them astray? Eliashib the priest was allied with him? Yep, that's precisely what occurred. Verse 5, and he had prepared for him a large room where previously they had stored the grain offerings, the frankincense, the articles, the tithes of grain, the new wine and oil, which were commanded to be given to Levites and singers and gatekeepers, and the offerings for the priests. Now, notice how our story becomes I again. It's personalized again. Apparently, Nehemiah had been away for a time, came back, and was made aware of this situation. For he says in verse 6, during all this, I was not in Jerusalem. For in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I had returned to the king. Then after certain days, I obtained leave from the king, and I came to Jerusalem, and I discovered the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah, in preparing a room for him in the courts of the house of God. Now, you couldn't note a more complete compromise. Actually, in the temple, he prepared a room for this man who was the enemy of God. He says in verse 8, it grieved me bitterly. Kind of sad, isn't it, the contrast here? In the first chapter of Nehemiah, he wept, didn't he? He wept because he heard the wall had not been built and the people in Jerusalem were suffering and he wanted to get down there and build that wall. The story ends now, he's weeping again. But this time he's weeping because in his absence, there had been a traitorous act committed. The man who was to be the leader of the people, the man who the people were to look up to, had committed a traitorous act. And it grieved him bitterly. Therefore I threw all the household goods of Tobiah out of the room. Couldn't help but comparing this with the Lord Jesus when he went by the temple and he saw how they had desecrated the temple, the sellers, they were making merchandise there at the temple. And it says the zeal of the house of the Lord just ate him up. And this is the same reaction of Nehemiah. You know, he wept within himself just to see what they were doing to the house of God. And he took those tables and threw them over and chased the men out, you know. And here we see Nehemiah's same reaction. He says, I threw all the household of goods of Tobiah out of the room. And then I commanded them, verse 9, to cleanse the rooms. And I brought back into them the articles of the house of God with the grain offering and the frankincense. I also realized that the portions for the Levites had not been given them, for each of the Levites and the singers who did the work had gone back to his field. So I contended with the rulers and said, why is the house of God forsaken? And I gathered them together and set them in their place. What a question. Stop and just think about it. Verse 11. Why is the house of God forsaken? It's a question I think in our day and age we have to ask. Because by and large, the house of God is forsaken. The place where God gathers with his people so often seems to take second place, doesn't it? And the remarkable thing here, you're going to notice as we move along in this chapter, is the reaction of Nehemiah to these things. Notice how keenly he reacts. He does not just brush these things aside. He doesn't, you know, he's not numb to what's happening. I guess, you know, one of the reasons this speaks to me is I think one of the greatest things can happen in the day in which you and I are living, when we see so many things going wrong, is for us to become indifferent to it. You know, just say, that's the way things are. You know, what can you expect? And we develop an indifference. But I want you to notice how he describes himself here. he grieved bitterly. I commanded them to cleanse the rooms. He says, I contended with the rulers. He faced them with it. He didn't try to avoid them or try to let it pass by. He says, I contended with the rulers. And he says, I gathered them together, set them in their place. Then it goes on, all Judah brought the tithe of the grain and the new wine and the oil to the storehouse. And I appointed as treasurers over the storehouse Shelemiah the priest and Zadok the scribe, and of the Levites, Pedaiah, and next to them was Hanan the son of Zachar, the son of Mattaniah, for they were considered faithful. And their task was to distribute to their brethren. Now, I think one of the things I like so much about the book of Nehemiah is the way these little statements are kind of just put in here. And do you notice the statement? They were considered faithful. Can you honestly say before God, as you think about your relationship with your assembly, you think about your relationship with the work of the Lord, could you be among those that we would say they were considered faithful? You know, you mentioned his name. Yes, he's a faithful brother. He's there when he's needed. He's at hand when the problem is, when there is a problem. He's ready to be used in whatever capacity he can be. He's a faithful brother. Paul was able to say that of a number of the servants of the Lord in his day. But it was a small list when you think about all the Christians that lived in his day. And so, that little statement, they were considered faithful, and their task was to distribute to their brethren. Now, look at 14. Has Nehemiah changed since we first began this study? He's got another problem. Here he is faced with the unfaithfulness of his people. He's faced with decline. He's faced with a definite departure. What does he do? He prays again. That's what he does. He did this all the way through the book, didn't he? He says, remember me, O my God, concerning this. Do not wipe out my good deeds that I have done for the house of my God and for its services. Now, what he means there is, in that statement, don't wipe out my good deeds. This is not, you know, he's not bragging before God of the good things he's done. That's not, we misunderstand the statement. What he means is, the work that I was enabled to do in rebuilding the wall, you know, in bringing the people together again in the city and so on, don't let that be wiped out by the evil of these men. You know, he was pleading for the work that had been accomplished. And many times the servant of God cries out in despair, oh God, you know, he may have spent years working with an assembly, building it up, and a couple of men come along later, you're going to wipe out the whole thing. You say, God, preserve this work. Don't let this happen. And that's basically what Nehemiah is doing here. 15. In those days, I saw in Judah some people treading wine presses on the Sabbath. They weren't supposed to be doing that. In fact, wasn't that one of the points they made in the covenant? That they would not labor to make money on the Sabbath. And that's basically what the purpose of this. I saw in Judah some people treading wine presses on the Sabbath, bringing in sheaves, loading donkeys with wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of burdens, which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. And I warned them about the day on which they were selling provisions. Another breakdown, isn't it? First, there was compromise with Tobiah. There was compromise with the enemy. Now there's a breakdown of the Sabbath. That which, when we say a breakdown of the Sabbath, we're basically saying that which should have been set aside for God, they're now using to make money for themselves. That's basically what we say. Verse 16. Men of Tyre dwelt there also, who brought in fish and all kinds of goods and sold them on the Sabbath to the children of Judah and in Jerusalem. Now, of course, if they hadn't bought it, he couldn't have sold it. And they weren't to buy on the Sabbath. But you see, all of this was developing. There was a profanity of the Sabbath day. Verse 17, then I contended with the nobles of Judah and said to them, what evil thing is this that you do by which you profane the Sabbath day? Did not your fathers do thus, and did not our God bring all this disaster on us and on this city? Yet you bring added wrath on Israel by profaning the Sabbath. So it was at the gates of Jerusalem as again be dark before the Sabbath that I commanded. Notice the order here. I contended, and then I commanded. He did not stand silently by and watch this. You know, he didn't say, this is going too far. What can we do now? You know, the people made a market day out of the Sabbath. You try to go in and break something like that up, you know. Well, I would just cause a lot of hardships for some families. And now we'll just have to kind of accept this as one of those. No. He contended. He commanded. This is the kind of leader that serves an example for us, doesn't it? For all times. And so he says, I commanded the gates to be shut and charged that they must not be opened till after the Sabbath. Then I posted some of my servants at the gates so that no burdens would be brought in on the Sabbath day. Now the merchants and sellers of all kinds of wares lodged outside Jerusalem once or twice. So I warned them. I warned them, he says, and said to them, why do you spend the night around the wall? If you do so again, I will lay hands on you. From that time on, they came no more on the Sabbath. And I commanded the Levites that they should cleanse themselves and that they should go and guard the gates to sanctify the Sabbath day. Now note this, for the second time, he says, remember me, O God. Concerning this, spare me according to the greatness of your mercy. You notice how after each evil he dealt with, you know, first he dealt with the evil of compromise with the enemy, with Tobiah. He cries out, remember me, O my God. Now he dealt with the evil of the Sabbath, profaning the Sabbath, and he cries out, remember me, O God. There was within this man, you see, we might almost say, totally taken up with wanting to please God. That's what he means by that statement. Remember me, O God. He wants his life to count for God. We can sense so remarkably here, his desire was not to please the people. His desire was to please God. Had he wanted to please the people, well, he just would have left Tobiah stay in his room there in the house. He could have, you know, kind of compromised and talked his way out. I said, well, I guess it hurt the man to be there. He probably, you know, maybe he's sincere. Maybe he really means to be different, and we'll kind of just see what happens, and we'll let him, you know. And he could have just left the Sabbath. No, he didn't care what the people thought. He didn't care of him. He didn't care what their attitude might be toward him. He was concerned about what God thought of him, not what the people thought of him. That was what drove him. That's what motivated him. Then we come to verse 23, as if this wasn't an end of it all. This would be enough. But the greatest sin of all, really, is now to be accounted. In those days, I also saw Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. And half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod and could not speak the language of Judah, but spoke according to the language of one or the other people. Mixed marriages. You know, we have to be careful when we look at a text like this. We don't misunderstand. Rahab married a Jewish man, but that was not a mixed marriage. And yet Rahab was from Jericho. She was not a Jew, but it wasn't a mixed marriage. I said, well, now wait a minute. If she was from Jericho, she was from one of the tribes, one of the people of the captivity, why wasn't it a mixed marriage? Well, it wasn't. Because Rahab had embraced the Jewish law. She had embraced the God of Israel. And she became a part of the camp of Israel. But what's being intimated here is that in these marriages, there was a compromise taking place. See, that's the key to the whole point. It's not just that they were marrying women who weren't Jews. It's that they were marrying women who refused to become Jews and would expect their husbands to turn their backs on Judaism, on the ways of the Jew, and take on their ways. That's why they began to speak their language. They weren't satisfied to speak Hebrew. They began to speak the language of the wives. And you see, the sad thing is, we see the results of what so clearly stated here. What can be the result of a mixed marriage? And the children spoke another language. You know, when you marry a woman or you marry a man who doesn't agree with you on the things of the Lord, he isn't given over to Christ, what's going to result is he is going to get control of the family, probably. Thank God there's exceptions to this. But he's going to get control of the family, and your children are going to start speaking his language. And they start speaking the language of the world. They start seeing things the way he sees it, rather than the way a Christian ought to see it. And this is the sad thing of what happens with mixed marriages. And of course, eventually, what would happen is, the Jew, of course, and worshiping the God of Israel would disappear. It would be swallowed up as these people intermarried. So he says in 25, here's the word again. Third time in here. I contended with him. No compromise in this. I contended with him and cursed them, struck some of them and pulled out their hair and made them swear by God, saying, you shall not give your daughters as wives to their sons, nor take their daughters for your sons or yourselves. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations there was no king like him, who was beloved of his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, pagan women caused even him to sin. Should we then hear of your doing all this great evil, transgressing against our God by marrying pagan women? One of the sons of Joida, the son of Eliashib, the high priest, was a son-in-law of Sanballat. First we have Tobiah, now we've got Sanballat. You see what's happening? The whole thing breaks down. Their enemies have now become part of the camp. And again, we see them compromising, you see, by intermarriage. 29, remember them, O my God, because they have defiled the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and the Levites. Thus I cleanse them of everything pagan. I also assign duties to the priests and the Levites, each to his service, and to bring the wood of offering and the first fruits at appointed times. Third time, after the third sin outlined, he cries out, remember me, O my God, for my good. Well, when leadership breaks down, it's sad. It's a sad business. We see how the priesthood here broke down. But thank God we have the example of a man who stood firm in the person of Nehemiah. May you and I be marked as those in these final sliding days of those who stand.